Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sometimes it really is the journey, not what you set out seeking in the first place. Nature writer William Dubiez started off on a trek to mountains deep inside Laos in search of the endangered and elusive Saula, a deer-like creature with two curved horns like the mythical unicorn. He lived off of sticky rice, trekked through remote forests, and crossed dangerous river passages. Along the way, he listened to the jungle, the birds, the frogs. He listened to the silence and thought deeply about what it will mean to the planet, for civilization, if this nature is not protected. This hour on Point, the search for the lost unicorn. You can join us on air or online. Is it time to redouble our efforts to save the last wild places and vanishing animals? Is it too late? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Santa Fe, New Mexico, is William Dubiez. His new book is The Last Unicorn, A Search for One of Earth's Rarest Creatures. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Bill, welcome to On Point. So nice to have you.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Jane.
Tell me how you became interested in searching for this endangered and elusive creature, the Saula.
Well, it was a strange point of entry for me. I had done a little bit of work in Borneo on orangutans and came back to the States and made a presentation on it. And a couple of weeks later, I was in my home in northern New Mexico, and a fellow who had heard the presentation rang me up and asked, "Have you ever heard of Saula?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "What?" And he went on to explain that this really beautiful animal was very rare, occurred only in the Annamite Mountains that divide Laos and Vietnam, and asked if I would be interested in writing about it. And I said, well, sure. And away we went.
So I described it as a deer-like creature with two curved horns, sort of like the mythical unicorn. How would you describe it? Add to that.
Well, it's about the size of a carousel pony. It can weigh up to about 220 pounds. Its horns have a very slight curve. They're very beautifully tapered and end in a very sharp point. They're actually not deers, although they look deer-like. They're more related to wild cattle, but they don't resemble any kind of cattle anyone has ever seen. These animals branched off the evolutionary tree on really just to themselves. They have no close relatives. And they've been living in this habitat probably for somewhere over, I don't know, anywhere between 5 and 20 million years.
So this is an animal unlike any on Earth, you're saying. Not just a new species that was discovered, but a new genus, right? So a mammal with no known relatives, no known close relatives.
No close relatives. Yeah, they may, the taxonomists are still sort of going back and forth on these things. And they may even be not just a singular species, a singular genus. They may be their own tribe, which is the next classification.
So why is the Saula under such grave threat?
Well, they probably have never in the recent millennia been plentiful in the mountains. But right now, those mountains are the scene of a kind of war on nature as animals of all kinds, everything from barking deer to turtles, are being extracted from the mountains, mainly by poachers, in order to feed a huge appetite for animal parts and products in the traditional Chinese medicine trade in principally China, but also in Vietnam and other nearby countries, and also to feed a booming business in status bushmeat restaurants. If you really want to impress your employer or your father-in-law, you might take him to a restaurant that serves fresh porcupine. And in that part of the world, and the effort to supply those restaurants and the medicinal trades means that big teams of professional poachers are crossing the mountains from Vietnam into Laos and basically snaring everything that walks or crawls.
So give us an example of how these poachers operate, why their efforts are so devastating.
Well, when we were in the deep bush back in the forests, far beyond the perimeter of the village world in Laos, we would on occasion come across snare lines that ran a kilometer in length or a kilometer and a half all the way along a ridge line or all the way from one ridge through a canyon bottom and up the other side. And these snare lines are hedges of death. They involve brush fences a yard high so that with gaps every 3 meters or so, and in each gap there is a snare hidden in the leaves, in the duff. And if any animal moving through that landscape would go through one of those gaps and risk putting its foot on the trigger of the snare, which would then release and flip the animal into the air, and it would hang by basically a bicycle brake cable until it died of thirst and trauma. Hmm.
And the poachers weren't necessarily after the sala per se, right? They were often trapping and netting more desired creatures, the ones that bring in big profits, the rhinoceros, the elephant tusks, tiger bones, these sorts of things. You mentioned the fresh porcupine. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Rhinoceros are already gone from that ecosystem, and the few elephants that remain are sequestered in a smallish area. But everything else, pretty much, is vulnerable to these snare lines, and the sala are not targets, as you say. Mm. They are more like bycatch, like a turtle being caught in a shrimper's net.
Here's some sound, Dr. Barney Long of the International Union for Conservation of Nature. The sala working group said that it's difficult to preserve the sala if there isn't cooperation on all fronts.
Despite the fact there's lots of individuals and groups working on sala conservation, it's not something that is easy to raise money for because few people know about it. And the challenges facing sala are so huge, we can only really save sala if we all pull together under one umbrella and work as one unit.
Talk about what you saw along in this expedition, along your journey. It was quite something, and you battled dehydration, fatigue, illness in your effort to find and hopefully save this sala.
It was quite a journey, I must say. And I was 61 when I made the journey, and most of the other members of the team were in their 20s. I went with a remarkable man, William Robichaud, who is the coordinator, really the chair of the sala working group you mentioned just a moment ago. And under his leadership, we covered a lot of ground in some very remote land. We saw some very discouraging, depressing sights in these snare lines I mentioned just a little while ago. But we were also, throughout the trip, immersed in the grandest kind of forest beauty you can imagine, surrounded by bird song, the sound of gibbons calling at dawn every morning, laughing thrushes, whole flocks of laughing thrushes cackling through the brush beside us. It was really a magical experience. Mm.
The New York Times calls your book, quote, an adventure tale, a meditation, an evocative read that makes clear why wild places matter and how difficult it will be to save them. I'm curious what this expedition revealed to you about habitat conservation generally that you didn't know before you went, even as a renowned and experienced biologist.
Well, I think one thing I could see graphically is that the challenges facing conservation in that environment are in many ways similar to what we experience in the United States and South America, wherever. It's a continual balancing or struggle between protecting the integrity of an area and making decisions about the economic use of the area. Specifically in that part of Laos, the business of protecting nature in the village environment is one thing, and there are big challenges there, but I think they can be met. The big factor that undermines everything is the presence of these professional companies of poachers coming across the mountains. The only thing that can be done to defend against them is really to block them with a military presence to stop the incursions.
Did you ever interact with the poachers?
No. You know, we had three militia in our group of 14, and they were armed with AK-47s in case we should encounter face-to-face a band of poachers. And one night at about 4 a.m., a line of little bouncing lights came down a mountain trail and almost into our camp. It was a group of poachers. Our people rallied and chased them off, and we didn't actually come to any conflict with them. But we did discover by the end of the trip that we had been kind of circling each other the entire time we were in the forest.
Why would you say your search for this creature is so important?
Well, I think what we're trying to demonstrate is, in a way, is how wonderful and how beautiful this planet is. And the Saula embodies that enigma, that beauty, that specialness. It is like a unicorn, like the unicorn of the medieval ages. And if we can hang on to that extraordinary element of beauty in the world, then maybe we can really learn to live on this planet as good stewards.
I'm not sure I can stay in suspense throughout the program. Do you want to tell us if you found evidence of the Saula deep in Laos?
On our trip, we did not. But just a few months later in Vietnam, the first photograph of a Saula in many a year was taken by a camera trap.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about an adventure deep into Laos this hour on a search for the elusive Saula and taking a big look at conservation and what can be done to protect wildlife around the world. Here's William Robichaud explaining to Laotian guides and members of the expedition that our guest earlier was speaking about how the wire animal traps work. This is a video shot during their expedition.
And then periodically they have an opening here, and an animal walks through the opening. And okay, meet. Quick look. Animal walks through, steps in the opening, and gets caught like that.
We're speaking this hour with William DeBuise, author of The Last Unicorn, and I'd like to bring another guest into the conversation now. Joining me in the studio is Azzedine Downs, CEO of the International Fund for Animal Welfare. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. So you've heard what the doctor has said here, his expedition in search of the Saula. Give us a sense of the scope of conservation efforts like his around the world.
You know, I had an opportunity to read the book. It's both inspirational and, I think, discouraging at the same time. That story plays out, I would say, around the world, whether you're in Africa or Asia or South America, even here in the United States. So it's just an incredible problem that oftentimes seems intractable. But there are incredible people around the world, whether or not they're in power to do something about it, but they are incredibly dedicated to what they do, and that gives me hope.
What are some of the fastest deteriorating habitats around the world?
Well, I would say that those habitats that the larger mammals need are in the greatest danger. When you look at the amount of land that an elephant needs to migrate. So any migratory species is really in trouble. Some of it is climate change, but just as much of it is human-caused. Mm-hmm. So there's land use. And particularly, I think the problem is driven by competition for resources, natural resources.
Hmm. I'm looking at a picture here of the president of the Republic of Congo setting fire to more than 5 tons of illegally hunted elephant tusks just last month. I guess this display was intended as a condemnation, a public condemnation of poaching that's going on there.
Yeah.
Places like Chad, like Ghana, Kenya, Zimbabwe. Can you talk about the resurgence in international demand for elephant tusks and rhinoceros horns, among other things?
Yeah. You know, the destruction of that ivory is an incredibly controversial undertaking. So more and more countries in the last 2 years have been destroying the ivory either through crushes or burning in this case. The moment that they do it, you will find that the economists come out and say that this is, in fact, making the problem worse.
Why?
Well, because they argue that it increases the price of ivory. So it's an economics 101 argument. But in the court of common sense and a lot of the UN bodies and other international fora that these discussions are argued, and conservation, believe me, is a political process far more than it is any sort of wildlife management. But the argument goes like this. That money could be used to be put into conservation. And a number of years ago, there was what they call a one-off sale of ivory, which means that 4 countries in southern Africa got permission to sell ivory to China. And the thought was this will sate the demand for ivory. But what we saw was an explosion of poaching. So it hasn't really proven to be a very strong economic argument. And the proof, I think, is in that poaching has increased. So exactly the opposite of what was predicted has happened.
Let me play some sound of this man named Corey Knowlton.
Yeah.
He bid $350,000 for a permit to hunt and kill a black rhino in northern Namibia, which he did last week. Here he is telling CNN that he is helping to preserve the future of black rhinos.
You've been heavily criticized for doing what you just did.
Yeah.
Do you still feel like what you did is going to benefit the black rhino in the future?
100%. I felt like from day one it was benefiting the black rhino. And I'll feel like that until, you know, the day I die.
Really?
It didn't benefit that rhino. That's the first thing I have to say. This is, something that's an incredibly powerful argument for countries that are desperate for funds.
So fewer than 5,000 black rhinos left in the world. Some activists do call this conservation hunting, right?
Yeah, that's a new term. I think that the term really is trophy hunting. And just with the advent of that CNN show or coverage of that killing of that rhino, I saw suddenly conservation hunting emerge as if it has some basis in science. And, you know, we just simply don't think it has any place in serious conservation.
Let's get a call in here from Tong in Akron, Ohio. Hi, Tong. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
First thing, I want to appreciate your guest today for interesting in the country which I came from. And I am a son of a settlement under CIA and also a son of a last rebel in Laos, and I'm very concerned because nowadays the governments are destroying the land and all the animals, especially elephant, and the salamanders are extinction. And I stand in here, I can't do anything about it, just living depressed and
hoping that something would change. Tong, thank you. Dr. DeBuise, how do you respond to that? Someone who wants to do something, but where's the political will to deal with some of these issues, the serious poaching, the corruption associated with this trade?
Well, I place my faith in the inspired and dedicated people out there on the ground working on these problems, people like Bill Robichaux, and you played few words from Barney Long, for instance. These people's efforts can be supported if people want to go to savethesaula.org. They can find out various ways to contribute money and provide moral support to these efforts. The work of conservation biologists out in the field through the Wildlife Conservation Society, the IUCN, WWF, other organizations is very sophisticated in most instances and very well targeted. And I think poco a poco, little by little, on many fronts, we're making some progress. The problem is that the poaching is like a tsunami coming at us, and we just have to ratchet up our efforts continually to try to offset it.
Azzedine Downs, is the work of conservationists, biologists, is it enough?
You know, I don't think it is enough in and of itself. For so long, I think we in the conservation field have sort of worked independently of one another. We've worked independently of others in other sectors. And there's been an incredible emphasis on the number of animals worldwide. That was conservation. What's the size of the population? And I think in all of these examples now, we're seeing that we have to cooperate with communities. We have to ensure and pressure, in fact, governments to fulfill the promises that they have made to a lot of communities living in and around wildlife. We have taken an approach now where we have been discussing with veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan wars coming back, and these were folks who were responsible for finding those people who were putting the roadside bombs in place. And they got to the point where they were saying, well, all we're doing is chasing these guys once the bomb has gone off. We want to get ahead of the kill. And so we have sat down with them and come up with ways to put that same intelligence work, working with defense contractors, intelligence agencies, intelligence units, even within the rangers and conservation scouts. And it's raising a lot of eyebrows. But in fact, you know, as we heard earlier, in many places, it is a war. It is a war against the professionalized poachers. It's not the villagers.
Let me just add that the groups I mentioned are focusing in almost every case on community-based conservation that works with the villagers, works with local communities. And I think what we've learned is that there are four elements to really successfully stopping poaching. One is for local communities to feel that they own the wildlife. Second is that they be able to deploy conservation scouts that keep eyes and ears out on the landscape. Third, that they be linked to being able to call in response forces to oppose the poachers when poachers are detected. And fourth, that in all this take place in an atmosphere without corruption. When there's collusion between poachers and the authorities, all is lost. When there isn't, a lot can be gained.
Here's Jeff in Montreal, Canada. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to On Point.
Yes. Hi, Jane. Thanks for the great topic. Back in 2001, a few of us eco-warriors went down to Belize, and we wanted to stop a Canadian company from building a dam in a very rich ecosystem. Unfortunately, the dam went through. It was built, a huge swath of the tropical rainforest was flooded. It was a Chinese company that was contracted to do the work, and of course the Chinese workers were flown in. They poached a lot of these animals and sent their skins and so forth back to China. But there were wonderful animals such as tapirs there, and their, of course, habitat disappeared. But as your guest said, one of the big problems is in these poor countries, corruption is so rampant that whatever laws there are, even in national parks, they're just not, they're on the books, but they're not applied.
Right.
And my point is that, second point is that these countries, they need to cooperate more regionally to ensure that these migratory corridors remain intact. They're just not doing enough together as a unit to protect the wildlife. And just very quickly, the ecosystems that exist are so rich, and when they disappear, I think they just impoverish the country.
Jeff, thank you. Therein lies the problem, Mr. Downs. As Jeff mentioned, and as Dr. DeBuise mentioned, the corruption within these local governments.
Yeah, no, it's an enormous problem, and I think that part of the problem that people don't have a great understanding of is, in fact, the amount of money that's involved. So when you look at wildlife trade, estimates up to $19, $20 billion per year. So that drives a lot of the corruption. I think also that the sums of money that are involved in development are also an issue. When we were discussing tigers, there's a global tiger initiative, and it was really led by the World Bank. And they said that they were going to put up $350 million U.S. dollars to double the number of tigers. So you have 3,200 tigers, up to 7,000 tigers. $350 million. And as I sat there with the Minister of Environment from Bhutan, he said, you know, one of the problems is that a tiger doesn't know how to repay a World Bank loan. They could not get boots for their rangers. So that notion of large multinational organizations that could bring the resources, in fact, is boiled away oftentimes in corrupt schemes, even at that level. So it's not just a bribe. I think a lot of times we talk about corruption as, well, someone is bribing a border guard. But the corruption really does go all the way to the large international organizations.
Here's Camille in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Camille. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question / idea. In terms of the World Wildlife Fund, it's an international organization, and I'm wondering if in terms there's been any thought of forming something modeled after the U.S. Peace Corps, but an animal corps, open internationally and not just to wealthy kids, as the Peace Corps is in America, who can go to college, but to all kids, where they can essentially go off to a foreign country and essentially be the protective shield and part of the conservation crew, so as to provide these safe corridors and perhaps even act as an entourage to these endangered species. Mm.
Interesting idea, Camille. Solution, Mr. Downs?
Yeah, you know, I was in the Peace Corps, and so I'm fond of it and what it can do. And in fact, in Malawi, we have a project where we involved Peace Corps volunteers working with the community on both deforestation projects, but also to protect wildlife. So there is a possibility there. Also, here at BU, there's the Center for Field Studies, and there's a lot of students who are going out to Kenya and working on conservation and village animation, if you will, to get them to protect wildlife.
Boston University and here in Massachusetts. In 2012, head ranger of the Vietnam Forest Protection Department said that in order to preserve the Saola, responsibility should be on everyone. The Saola is the rarest animal in the world, and in Vietnam it is under threat of extinction, he says. This is why I feel everyone, especially the Vietnam Forest Protection Department, should be responsible. Dr. DeBuise, I mean, maybe everyone should be responsible, but they sure aren't. And I'm curious, do you ever get discouraged? Do you ever hear all these very discouraging statistics and see what you see out there and ever think, boy, I'm not sure I'm going to make it?
Well, yes, I think all of us in this line of work become discouraged. One of the things in my book that was most important to me, I'll have to say, was a journey to understand something about how to balance optimism with fatalism. You know things are bad. They'll probably get worse. But there's still always that ray of hope, that possibility that you can make a difference and save a little bit of the beauty of the world. If you internalize that, you keep on going.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the world's most remote places and the wonders of nature that are threatened and, in many cases, in danger of extinction. What is there and what would be lost if we don't get serious about protecting it? Speaking to CNN in April, an employee of the Ol Pejeta Conservancy in Kenya says three northern white rhinos are critical to saving the species.
There are only five remaining in the world, of which three are here in Ol Pejeta. And, of course, the sort of last hope for saving the species really relies on these ones here.
We're speaking this hour with Azzedine Downs, CEO of the International Fund for Animal Welfare, and with William Dibuiz. He's the author of the new book, The Last Unicorn. Joining me now from Nairobi, Kenya, is Shivani Bala, founder and director of the Iwaso Lions. Their mission is to conserve Kenya's lions and other large carnivores by promoting coexistence between people and wildlife. Shivani, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thank you, Jane.
Tell me, how bad is the situation on the ground with regard to these lions where you are?
So, Jane, generally the situation in Kenya and in Africa is very serious. Lion numbers are declining very rapidly. But where I am, up in northern Kenya, in Bamburu, I work with the local community who are camels, and of course, it's part of the preventative of their livestock. So we're working with the community and really encourage and promote coexistence. A number of community and education programs set up to really work with the community and teach them.
It's the community-based education. Shivani Bala, I'm sorry our line to Nairobi is not good today. We'll try to fix that and get back to you. Azzedine Downs, talk about the education versus the action piece of all this.
Yeah, you know, one thing I've always been struck with over the years is that there are a lot of people who say, oh, if people only knew, and this is something that I enjoyed in The Last Unicorn, if you could convince the villagers that this animal is only extant in their area, they might do something about it. Everywhere I go, and I lived in Yemen years ago, there was a young boy selling leopard skins. And we went in and we told him, you know, this was forbidden. He said, well, there are millions of them, millions of them. And no matter what we told this young fellow, we couldn't convince him. So it's really the people who live in and around the wildlife who I think are the best spokesmen. But even then, knowing something doesn't mean people will take action. And climate change is a perfect example. You could have as much science as you want. It doesn't mean there's going to be action. So there has to be advocacy as well as work on the ground.
Dr. Dibuiz, did you come across that attitude, that perspective among villagers in Laos and other places?
Yes, you could see people's eyes widen as they absorb the idea that the Saola didn't occur in other places. We were asked, you know, do you have many Saola in the United States? No, we have none. Mm-hmm. Well, there must be a lot of them in Africa. No, there are none there either. They're only here where you live. And when that thought sinks in, people recalibrate completely. They think, oh, we have something unique here, something for us to be proud of. And you can see the wheels turning and the calculations going in a new direction.
Here's Rama from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Hi, Rama. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you. Hi, yes. Hi, Jane and guests. Great topic. A couple of points. What Camille brought up was amazing. I think that is so, so crucial to involve people, especially young people. I've often thought, wouldn't it be nice to be able to require everyone before they're 25 to live in a foreign country for 6 months? It would make this world such a more peaceful place. Mm. But my main point I wanted to get to was the guests, and we keep talking about the poachers. Well, can we somehow reach these poachers and turn them around and bring them into, and has there been some success in some parts of the world, including the poachers and the environmental protection in action? Or are they just too far gone? Are they just such a criminal element that we can't reach them? Are they just thugs, corrupt people? Are they human beings like the rest of us? Can we possibly reach them? Unless we really target them and so they don't need to poach so much or so bad, can't we somehow reach out to them and reach them and help them be part of the solution?
Rama, thank you. Bill DeBuise, what do you think?
Well, I think the key in general is to build strong constituencies everywhere for nature and for wildlife, and to leave the door open for poachers to abandon their ways and to join the majority who want to live in some kind of sustainable relationship with nature. The target has to be, though, not just poachers, but the whole community. We really need to build these constituencies. And in some places, things are working very, very well. The market in shark fins for shark fin soup is down 82% in Guangzhou, China, the main shipping area for that, because of public education programs. Mm. These things can work. They can shift cultural views. It takes a generation, perhaps, at times to do so. And we just have to hold on to the islands of great diversity, of great natural bounty, while these kinds of shifts take place. Knock wood that we're successful in making those shifts.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And I think that we can, and we have reached local poachers. Those on the low end of the poaching chain, if you will, there are plenty of examples in Kenya and China, India, other places around the world where people were really poaching to try to sustain their families. But beyond that, the poaching is really not a poverty issue. It's a criminal issue. These are large organized crime syndicates that are able to move and pay for 30 tons of ivory going to China. So that's a very, very different situation, and that needs governments, forensics on financials, who's paying for these things. You now see the airlines, a number of airlines, including South Africa Airways, saying that they will no longer transport things like ivory, even if there is a permit, even if there is a CITES permit. So there is hope, but it does take the governments at those high ends. Public awareness in China, absolutely. We work in China. We see declines of 54% once people understand that an elephant has to die.
Very optimistic.
Yeah.
Let's get Gail in here from Fish Creek, Wisconsin. Hi, Gail. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Earlier this year, I happened to be watching the Bloomberg channel, and a comment came on from the people that were handling the one segment that there were like over two dozen baby elephants for sale out of Zimbabwe. And, oh, wouldn't that be terrific? Oh, I'd love to own a baby elephant. My hair went on fire. I called every conservation group I could possibly get a phone number for and get somebody on the phone to tell them what I had just heard go internationally through Bloomberg, this ignorance that was out. They said nothing about how in danger they are, the abuse that they go through, ripping them from their mothers, this horrific information that these people did not even care to even mention or probably even know about. This is the challenge that we have to try to take care of these animals.
Indeed. It is a challenge, Gail. I appreciate your call and the information. Let me play some sound here on that note of an interview with a television station in Kenya, KTN. It's a Kenyan wildlife conservationist here weeping in front of the carcass of a beloved 45-year-old African elephant who was killed by poachers for his massive ivory tusks.
Very painful. We need the government to do something. We want to improve this thing. We want to conserve.
Here's Juan in Tamarack, South Korea. Juan, welcome to you.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to mention about these millionaires that are paying high money to go out and hunt tigers, elephants, rhinos, just to show their ego, and they don't get punished like the king of Spain, who just got little snap on the hand, and that was it. There should have been something measured to show all these people that their ego is not to kill the beauty of the animals out there. And places like China, where all these new millionaires are getting, they're paying high money to go out and hunt for the ivory, for all that. And what we do is we still buy more finished goods from China. It's a country that nobody does anything about it. And as long as we keep buying goods from China, they're going to keep doing whatever they want to do.
Juan, thank you. A new sport for the wealthy, Mr. Downs?
Yeah. One of the arguments that I find just absolutely absurd is that now it's time for trophy hunting to have its chance, when in fact we know from a number of species gone extinct in the past that hunting contributed to that. So there's no way that they could come forward and say that this is some new method for conservation.
The U.S. has become the second largest market for illegal wildlife products, a major conduit to Asia. Talk about the U.S. involvement in this problem.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting issue. It's one that I think really hobbles us on the international stage. There's a lot of criticism of China, and we hear that in the callers. But the fact of the matter is that the United States has over 5,000 tigers kept as pets in Texas alone. Estimated up to 20,000 tigers kept in the United States, roadside zoos, circuses, et cetera, et cetera. So when we go after China and say, you need to do something about this situation, they say, you have more tigers in Texas than there are left in the wild. So that's a criticism against us. The other thing in terms of the United States and trophy hunting is that most of those hunters are, in fact, Americans. Mm-hmm. And the loopholes with ivory are such, and the Obama administration is now trying to grapple with this. There's a lot of resistance against the new regulations, which would not outlaw the ownership of ivory in the United States, but it would make it illegal to sell it. Oddly enough, antiquities dealers, musicians, and the NRA came forward to oppose those regulations. So the problem that we have on the international level is that, in fact, there is a lot going on in the United States that could improve. It makes it very difficult on the international stage to then criticize others. China, for example, is probably one of the only countries in the world that has a certificate program for the buying and selling of ivory. It doesn't work, but they could at least point to it and say it's a failed system, whereas in the United States, we have nothing.
Dr. DeBuise, would you add to that?
Well, I think some of these things are very important to focus on, but we need to keep our eye on the whole of the situation. And right now, for instance, Southeast Asia has the highest degree of endemism, that is to say animals found only there, of any region in the world. And it also has the greatest proportion of its animals critically endangered in danger of extinction. And so if the world really cares about biodiversity, we've got to focus on those hot spots. And it's not just trophy hunting. It's often every animal in the ecosystem being taken for some medicinal use or food or whatever. And so we have to look at the whole situation, not just the headline-making extraordinary matters.
Here's Bill in Rutland, Vermont. Hi, Bill. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Just wanted to get the opinion of the folks here about the parallels with the drug war in the United States and the futility of it in the last 30 years. We have done nothing to curtail the demand, therefore the supply is there. Mm. Thank you.
Bill, thank you. Mr. Downs?
Yeah, that's something that we grapple with a lot. I think there are many arguments put forward that, in fact, we should legalize all, whether it's trophy hunting or all trade in animal, live animals or animal parts. One, I think you're dealing with live beings. It's not the same as drugs in terms of what harm is brought to oneself. But secondly, the issue of, you know, could we control the market? And this was the argument put forward with the sale of ivory. Let's flood the market. And you hear this often. Let's flood the market with ivory. Let's flood the market with rhino horn. The demand is so overwhelming, you could literally kill every elephant on the face of the earth today. And everyone who now has, according to a McKinsey report in China, discretionary income to buy a kilo of ivory and provide them with that ivory. So I just don't think that legalization is going to work because simply you don't have that supply in economic terms.
Do you agree with that, Dr. DeBuies?
Yes, I do. And I think the emphasis has to be on securing islands of safety for large concentrations of biodiversity. I mean, we're not going to win this war on all fronts at all times. But if we can preserve the key areas and really put our energies into those areas, we can do pretty well. And that's different from the war on drugs, which is pervasive throughout all regions. But if we can hang on to these islands of protection, we can get through this.
What's your sense of the scope of conservation work needed ahead of you, Dr. DeBuies, to preserve not only the Sala but other endangered species?
Well, as Mr. Downs has said, we need the commitments of national governments as well as the inspired work of many, many NGOs. And one of the emphases of the NGOs these days that come from the UK or the United States is to build national capacity in every nation in which they're working, to train local, national people to do this work themselves. And we find great response, and this is the key to building the constituencies we need to protect nature in these places.
Quick final word.
We all have to work together, decide what we're best at, and do it.
Azzedine Downs, CEO of the International Fund for Animal Welfare, thank you so much for being with
thank
me here
you.
In the studio.
Pleasure.
Appreciate it. And William DeBuies, author of the new book, The Last Unicorn, A Search for One of Earth's Rarest Creatures. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Jane. It's been great.
You can continue the conversation, listeners, and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.